Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. This week we present Karen Hobart Flynn, president of Common Cause, who assesses the significance of the New York Times report detailing the president's non-payment of taxes and the exposure of Trump and his family members to future criminal charges. Arisha Hatch, vice president of Color of Change, who talks about her group's response to the Kentucky Attorney General's decision to bring no charges against police officers who killed Breonna Taylor in her own apartment. And Mark Abraham, executive director of Data Haven, who reviews some of the important findings of a survey his group conducted in Connecticut about the impact the coronavirus pandemic has had on daily life. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
During the summer, President Donald Trump visited Midland, Texas, to boast of expanding oil exports from fracking energy reserves. Over the past decade, America's oil output has more than doubled and its gas production increased by over 50%. America is now the world's top producer of both fuels. But in its latest World Energy Outlook, published on September 14th, British Petroleum argues that demand for oil may already have peaked and could go into steep decline. This is because of an acknowledgement by most countries that, for the sake of the climate, reliance on fossil fuels needs to come to an end. The Economist reports the battle for the future is who can produce the electricity to power the digital age. While China is now the world's largest oil importer, Beijing is using its industrial power to boost renewable energy technologies. The East Asian giant has a global supply chain to build solar panels and electric vehicles on a massive scale. The key to China's success is its unique access to rare earth metals. China makes 70% of the world's solar panels and has half the global manufacturing capacity for wind turbines. In the meantime, the cost of solar panels and batteries has fallen by more than 80% over the last decade. As China and the European Union expand their investment in green energy technologies, Trump and his fossil fuel allies in the U.S. are headed in the opposite direction of the rest of the world. Secret financial records reveal global banks continue to move trillions of dollars in illicit funds across the globe. These transactions, in violation of anti-money laundering regulations, aid corrupt officials, drug traffickers, and terrorists. The top enablers of dirty money are J.P. Morgan, HSBC, Standard Chartered, Deutsche Bank, and Bank of New York Mellon. These banks were cited in over 2,100 leaked suspicious activity reports from the U.S. Department of the Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. The documents were obtained by BuzzFeed and shared with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists that conducted a 16-month investigation. The findings come after these financial institutions pledged to reform their money laundering controls after signing deferred prosecution agreements with U.S. federal prosecutors. J.P. Morgan, the leading U.S. bank which reached several money laundering settlements, was cited for its involvement in money laundering schemes related to a sovereign wealth fund in Malaysia, a shakedown of energy companies in Venezuela, and complicity in processing $50 million in payments to Paul Manafort, Trump's convicted 2016 campaign chairman. Overall, the investigation identified over $2 trillion in suspected illicit transactions over an 18-year period. Much of the laundered funds ended up in secret accounts in offshore tax havens such as the British Virgin Islands, Cyprus, Hong Kong, the United Arab Emirates, Russia, and Switzerland. Joe Biden's election prospects may reside in African-American neighborhoods in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 4 years ago, turnout of black voters in Wisconsin's largest city fell by 41,000 voters, nearly twice the margin that Donald Trump had won in the swing state in 2016. Democrats say they have learned their lesson not to ignore Milwaukee, but the city faces a long legacy of racism, economic decay, and growing frustration with the political establishment. Milwaukee has also been the target of intensive voter suppression efforts by the Republican Party, where a small swing in turnout can shift statewide elections. According to the Guardian newspaper, former Republican Governor Scott Walker passed onerous voter ID laws, curtailed early voting, gerrymandered district maps, and made it more difficult to register new voters that all contributed to reducing turnout in Milwaukee 4 years ago. Until the late 1970s, Milwaukee was a magnet for black migration to secure good-paying industrial jobs. The Rust Belt city fell on hard times as auto factories transitioned into Walmarts and fast food joints, and incomes for blue-collar black families fell. African Americans in Greater Milwaukee now earn only 42% of what white families make. Vaughn Mays, a 33-year-old Milwaukee activist, identified an important barrier to increasing voter turnout when he said people are tired of voting for candidates who bring little to no change. Folks don't see their everyday life and issues change, so the attitude is, why continue to participate? This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
A groundbreaking investigation by the New York Times revealed that President Donald Trump paid only $750 in federal income taxes the year he won the presidency, and the same amount during his first year in the White House. The Times report, based on the president's tax returns the paper says was leaked to them, states that Mr. Trump paid no taxes in 10 of the 15 years prior to his presidential campaign. Questions raised in the report include whether or not Mr. Trump illegally misrepresented his income and taxes, and the extent of his failure as a businessman. The president consistently refused to release his taxes over the 4 years of his time in office. The average U.S. citizen pays $12,200 in taxes each year, 16 times what the president has paid. The spotlight on Mr. Trump's taxes draws attention to long-running demands for reform of the U.S. tax system to ensure the wealthiest Americans aren't able to use complex loopholes to avoid paying their fair share in taxes, which exacerbates historic levels of economic inequality. Your reporter spoke with Karen Hobart Flynn, president of Common Cause, who assesses the significance of the Times report on the president's non-payment of taxes, the impact, if any, on the November 3rd election, and the exposure of Trump and his family members to future criminal charges.
From my perspective, one of the most dangerous things that we should be looking at is that he has a number of loans that he personally guaranteed that are coming due, which are, you know, millions of dollars. And the question, I think, remains who may end up helping him with this debt that he has. There are opportunities for foreign entities or special interests to bail him out. We wouldn't necessarily know if any of that happens because let's be honest, he has battled and fought continuously to block Congress, a court in New York State who are investigating his taxes and his financial records. He has fought to protect this from public view. And so to me, that's one of the most dangerous pieces of this is, you know, he has these money-losing businesses, and who is going to bail him out and how is he going to be bailed out dealing with that? And I think that, you know, people could leverage power over him were they to lend him money or help him with those bills. And some of what I know they're looking at in New York, we saw nothing in here about any Russian banks helping the president, but I do think that's one thing that people are looking at, you know, going way back as a way to possibly explain his loyalty to Putin despite his many challenges.
Mm-hmm. And Karen, I did want to ask you about this. Although much of what Donald Trump did in terms of taking advantage of loopholes for the wealthiest Americans.
Mm-hmm.
This reporting again spotlights the fact that there is one tax system for the very wealthy of this country and another for the rest of us. And beyond what Donald Trump may have done in terms of unethical behavior in his business capacity and in filing his taxes, it really opens up a whole other discussion about the urgent need for reforming the tax system so it's not so grossly unfair and perpetuates economic inequality in this country.
Right. Right. No, and, you know, one of the things that he did, you know, fairly early in his tenure was to give what was billed as tax relief for all Americans, and really it was tax relief for the wealthiest at the very top. And, you know, the Americans are suffering now like they haven't since probably, you know, the late 1920s with a global pandemic, historic levels of unemployment. And as we are entering this fall and have not, you know, this administration has botched the effort to get and contain this COVID-19 pandemic, we are going to see these spikes going up. And my guess is, even though we've seen states and Trump trying to push kids back into schools, we're going to see kids coming home, schools shutting down as we enter, you know, flu season, coupled with the fact that we don't have the testing we need, the supplies we need to battle COVID. And so I think the economic inequality that we see is going to get worse.
I'm sure we don't know all the story about this tax situation with Donald Trump, but is there any indication from where you sit that Donald Trump could be open to criminal charges regarding his misrepresenting his earnings and his cash flow?
I think that is absolutely the case, and there's even some reports that Ivanka Trump could face legal repercussions because one of the things that they found in the taxes is that while she was working as an employee of the Trump Organization, she was also received a large amount of consulting fees, which is not something the IRS would allow. And it's also a way they can sort of act as if they have more expenses than they have. I also think that the New York State investigators who are looking at his financial records and his taxes may also bring charges. So I do think that that's a real challenge, and I also think it is a, you know, another reason why he wants to be reelected, to put off, at least in the case of any federal charges.
That was Karen Hobart Flynn, president of Common Cause. For more analysis and commentary on the revelations of President Trump's non-payment of taxes, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On September 23rd, Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron announced the long-awaited grand jury decision in the shooting death of Breonna Taylor by Louisville police. The grand jury decided that none of the officers involved in Taylor's death will be indicted for murder or manslaughter. Only one of the officers, Brett Hankinson, is being charged with 3 counts of first-degree wanton endangerment for firing his gun into a neighbor's apartment. The attorney general maintained that the use of force by officers was justified because Taylor's boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, was the first to fire his gun when police burst into the apartment, wounding one of the officers. Breonna Taylor's family reacted with anger and disappointment as they demanded the release of grand jury proceeding transcripts. The decision not to charge the officers who killed Taylor triggered renewed racial justice protests in Louisville and across the U.S. In addition to leaked police body camera video in the aftermath of the shooting, a grand juror in the Breonna Taylor case has charged that Kentucky's attorney general may have misrepresented to the public the case he presented to the panel and urged full public disclosure of the proceedings. Your reporter spoke with Arisha Hatch, vice president of Color of Change, who talks about her group's response to the decision not to bring charges against police officers who killed Breonna Taylor, and the broader issue of systemic racism in law enforcement and the judicial branch.
Well, the news is certainly devastating and both shocking but unsurprising, if that's possible at all. There was no justice for Breonna or her family in this case. And so, you know, we know that our members, as well as many members on our staff, feel that this is a very unjust decision and showed a complete lack of empathy from Cameron. And I think that's the thing that struck us the most.
Some of the commentary we heard about the decision not to go forward on charges against the police officers involved in the raid and the death of Breonna Taylor was that Breonna's boyfriend was said to have fired a shot, and therefore the police were justified in firing back. That's the essential defense of what the Kentucky Attorney General did in this case.
Well, there always seems to be a justification for the murder of Black people. We've seen many instances where people have been arrested safely, even though there are guns involved. And so we find that justification to be really unfair to Breonna and to her family. He had the right, as far as we know, to own a gun and had the right to self-defense and defend his property when someone was entering without his knowledge. And so, but we see this time and time again that there are justifications given when police overstep their boundaries or don't employ good practices in their investigative work.
There's newly released video of the immediate aftermath of the police raid that killed Breonna Taylor that showed Fire Detective Brett Hankinson walking into the crime scene after the incident looking for shell casings with a flashlight, and that seemed to be a very blatant violation of police protocol. What can you tell us about what we've learned from this video that was leaked?
I still personally haven't seen the video yet, but we are pushing for more transparency. We're happy that the video has been released. We also want to see more transparency in the grand jury process that just happened. We want to understand more about what actually happened before and after Breonna's murder, and we want to be engaged in a deeper conversation about the improper police practices that led to her murder.
Arisha, how can we reform the system where police are not investigating themselves when it comes to violating their rules of engagement or protocols? It seems that in so many cases, we have the police investigating themselves, where there's obviously opportunities to taint a case and taint evidence. Have we seen any examples around the country where these types of reforms will prevent the fox guarding the chicken coop?
Well, one of the things that we're really focused on is really pushing on prosecutors, district attorneys, and attorney generals. We believe that they are a key intervention point in holding police officers who overstep accountable. And we just haven't seen that a lot across the country, although we're beginning to see it more and more. Color of Change PAC has helped to elect more than a dozen prosecutors across the country who are more progressive in nature, who don't believe in tough on crime rhetoric or policies, and who have pledged to hold police accountable. And what we really saw happen in this case was we had an attorney general in Cameron who was supposed to be a prosecutor for the people. He is supposed to be a prosecutor for victims and victims' families and not a defense attorney for the police, which is the way that he behaved in this case, we believe.
And Arisha, in looking at the election coming up, there are so many issues that our nation is confronting at the moment. This vacant Supreme Court seat, we've got the coronavirus pandemic, the Trump taxes, and I mean, there's so much on the plate of everybody here in this country. What is your group doing to ensure that during the debates that are coming up between candidate Vice President Joe Biden and Donald Trump, that the issues of systemic racism and very real problems of police violence are addressed by these candidates? And not only these candidates, but candidates running for Congress and the Senate.
Well, part of what we're trying to do is engage the media who are actually running the debates around how they're going to talk about these issues throughout the debates. We're obviously watching to see how not only the candidates address the racial justice issues that we care about, but how moderators, how the media actually prompts these questions. And we will continue to be engaged with folks holding future debates about how they engage politicians about the issues that matter so much to our members and to our family.
That was Arisha Hatch, Vice President of Color of Change. Learn more about the important issues involved in the Breonna Taylor murder case by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Connecticut was one of the hardest-hit states in America during the early days of the coronavirus pandemic, mostly because of its proximity to New York, which has the highest COVID-19 death toll in the nation. As in other states, Black and Latinx residents, as well as nursing home residents, were disproportionately affected by the virus. However, by June, the numbers of infections and deaths significantly decreased, and the state started gradually and cautiously to open up. Data Haven is a nonprofit Connecticut organization that gathers and interprets data, which supplements information collected by federal, state, and local governments and agencies. The group seeks to capture more local-level data that often isn't represented in other surveys, with the goal of discovering what people are most concerned about that determines their health, happiness, sense of community, and overall well-being. In August this year, Data Haven conducted a scientific random survey of 1,100 adults in the state, asking people about their experiences around the COVID-19 pandemic. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Data Haven's executive director, Mark Abraham, about some of the survey's important findings, how that data is being used, and why he believes other states across the U.S. could benefit from collecting similar data.
So one area that is relevant currently is the COVID-19 pandemic and how residents feel, how they think they'll fare in that as things go on. So some of the questions we asked on our survey were about people's belief that their employer, if they're, you know, going out to work on a regular basis, that their employer is, you know, taking appropriate safety precautions, and also just questions generally about, like, if people feel like that they could get the care they need if they were to become sick or if someone in their family were to get sick. And sort of across the board there, we see a couple differences that are important. You know, overall, people are relatively, you know, mixed on how confident they feel about their safety. Some people are very confident. Some people are very concerned. But we do see a pattern that adults who, you know, are leaving the home or to go out to work, they're more concerned. And adults who are in the communities that were more affected by the virus in terms of, like, higher deaths and hospitalizations, are much more concerned. They report, like, they've lost friends and family or have had friends hospitalized. They're just reporting generally, like, that they're not as confident about how things are going to progress from here. So I think that's an important factor to consider when we're designing interventions around health, is trying to address what those concerns are, understanding where they are.
Can you talk about the data you got regarding mask wearing?
So I think it's an experience that all of us have as we leave the home or take the bus to work or whatever we do. We see some people are wearing masks and some people aren't. So we did ask how often people are wearing them in our survey, and people reacted to that. They saw that, you know, some groups are very likely or almost always wearing masks. Other groups are much more mixed. So particularly white men in Connecticut, they're reporting that they're wearing masks at a lower rate than other groups. 81% of Connecticut residents are reporting that they're wearing it, you know, as frequently as possible. But it varies. It's 95% among African Americans, very high rate there. It's higher among women, but if you look at men and, you know, younger adults, the rates are below 80%. So that gives you a sense of the difference there. That's something people reacted to and sort of bringing up the issue, trying to educate and, you know, maybe reinforce to groups that are wearing masks that it's important to continue to do that. It's a thing that's helping everyone get through this.
Mark Abraham, did anything surprise you in the data?
Yeah, so one of the most interesting findings on the survey, which may not be surprising, but when we asked people how often they leave their house to go to work, we found adults who are earning $100,000 or more, they're mostly still staying home. And this is as of August. They're not leaving their home at all to go to work, whereas adults earning less than $100,000, they're mostly leaving their home every day, basically, to go to work. So that's a huge difference in people's experiences of the pandemic. And that difference in who leaves home to go to work, it breaks down along racial lines as well, with most Black and Latino adults reporting they leave home to go to work very often, whereas white adults are still mostly staying at home.
How is the data from this survey being used?
We're seeing it used in planning in a government setting or foundation setting for local healthcare, like basically how people are thinking about where to divert resources, like which programs to expand and where to expand them. So I think it's informative to have like concrete numbers about where the levels of concern are, which communities are more impacted by things like job loss or concerns about the vaccine are really high profile because of the need to get the flu vaccine out, maybe more than we have in past years. So that's an example where, you know, we know from previous data that certain communities were like much less likely to get a flu vaccine. So it's helpful to have this additional data that like looks at the COVID vaccine and if people trust healthcare systems and local government and topics like that in order to kind of direct the funding to where it's most needed around the flu vaccine and eventually the other vaccine if one becomes available.
Do you think it would be good if other states did this same kind of survey and got this kind of information?
Yeah, I think they would find it useful. We think, especially in the context of like tracking it over time. So like we've done the survey in the past and we will be continuing it in the future. So being able to monitor how things are changing is particularly helpful looking at the state of communities.
That was Mark Abraham, Executive Director of Data Haven. Learn more about the group's recent survey on the pandemic's impact on daily life in Connecticut by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, KKFI in Kansas City, Missouri, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.